Hello, and welcome to the Weekly News Roundup, a podcast of the Daily News. My name is Ann Brennan, and I'm the editor-in-chief of the Metro West Daily News and the Milford Daily News. On Fridays, we discuss local stories that made the headlines with reporters who covered them. This week, we'll talk about an Upton resident who's getting heat for a sign he has in his yard. Hundreds of people came out to honor the memory of the late state representative, Chris Walsh, and teachers and alumni say goodbye to Marion High School in Framingham. Last week, the owners of Walden Woods Brewery in Marlboro announced that they wouldn't be opening after all, and this was a business scene that would be a catalyst to revitalizing Marlboro's downtown area. What happened, why it was that they went this far down the line and then at the last minute couldn't follow through, because this was, or were unable to open. Mm-hmm. This was a effort by Marlboro, like I said, to attract a brewery. I think they were offering loans and other things, too.
They haven't been the easiest people to get a hold of.
Mm-hmm.
I've exchanged emails and Facebook messages because that's the only way I had to get a hold of them.
Yeah.
All they've been saying is financial difficulties, and they cited the incident with the pipe initially. But speaking to the landlord today, the pipe was actually fixed within 4 days. And he said it was less than 5 gallons of water actually on the floor.
So what they had described as a flooding incident was not.
It wasn't
There was a plumbing issue, but not what maybe it appeared to be.
The landlord, frankly, seemed a little surprised. And just from covering the beer industry for the last dozen years or so, I've never seen a brewery so ready to be open, not open, because the hardest parts were done. All the permits were done. Everything was installed. All the infrastructure, like the plumbing and the drainage and the electric, because you have to have a different electrical system than most places because of all the equipment. You have to have more access to water because you're using so much water. They have the cold room, which is basically a large walk-in refrigerator. Everything was set. Even there today, they had stacks of ingredients still stacked up, and they had cases of glassware with branded glassware. I'm still trying to reach the owners again today. Yep. I haven't heard back from them, but the landlord said he had approximately 15 potential tenants who want to move in to open a brewery there. In fact, when I was there to interview him, he had to cut the interview short because one was coming in to come in. So it's going to be interesting. In the long term, I actually don't think it will affect how many breweries are coming to Marlboro, just because just unrelated, the day before this got announced, I had written a story about Strange Brew, the homebrew shop in Marlboro, getting permits to open their own brewery. So it went from 2 to 3 back to 2 within a 2-day period.
Right. Well, it sounds like somebody could come in and buy this operation, or at least.
The landlord expects that the folks from Walden Woods are going to either leave the equipment as part of leaving the lease or sell it to whoever comes in. But again, the biggest issue, and this is talking to brewers over the years, is finding a location that, one, can support the infrastructure for a brewery, and two, has the infrastructure, because that's a huge cost. That's already done. All the building permits you normally would have to is already taken care of. So I would think this would be a desirable location for someone who was interested in opening a brewery.
Okay. Well, Norm, thanks for following up on that, and we'll wait to see what happens. I'm sure you'll have news next week.
I hope so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Blighted properties such as the Mount Waite Plaza in Framingham have long been a sore spot among residents and town officials. Earlier this week, a new chapter opened for this old shopping site. Jim Hattadine joins us to talk more about that. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Ann.
So what's going on at this site now?
There's a lot of excitement around what's going on at the site, which is they are finally tearing down a very ugly building that has been there for a number of years without any real occupants or any real productive use. So people have really, really been pushing to get something going at this plaza for more than a decade. And finally, a developer who's coming in to build apartments is taking action to tear down that building and get the project going. So I think there's a lot of excitement there.
It also had a very ugly sign that people really complained about. And I think there was a lawsuit even about that sign.
Yeah, there was a whole legal battle over this sign. There is a long history of kind of antagonism between town officials, city officials, and the person who owned that property for a long time. So the sign is gone. The gas station that was there is gone. And we had a photographer stop by this week who snapped some photos of the first kind of corner of the building being demolished. So within by the end of June, I think the property is going to be cleared, and they're based on development, which is working on the project, hopes to get a building permit by the end of the month with the aim of starting construction in August.
And how many units is this going to be in this apartment?
It's planned for 210 apartments. It looks like it's going to be upscale, a very nice place to live if you can afford it. They've got a clubhouse that's planned on the corner at the intersection of Mount Wade Ave and Franklin Street. And we've got a rendering of what that's going to look like. It's got these fire pits outside. There's a swimming pool. There's a gym and a meeting space and everything. So I think they're really marketing this toward you know, millennials who are looking for something like this, if they're, you know, in some kind of good paying job and looking for somewhere to live outside the city, people looking for those kind of amenities in an apartment building. And from what I understand, they're also kind of envisioning that this will be appealing to a broader range of people, not just the young working professionals, but also commuters of various types, maybe people who are looking to downsize from a larger home or something like that, who are later on in life.
Can you remind me how close it is to the train station for the commuter rail? Is it walking distance?
Depends how much you like walking, I guess. It's not super far away. It's not, you know, I think people who really, really want to be right beside the train station are going to perhaps look to the other options being created downtown. So you have two other luxury apartment buildings coming in within a half mile of the train station. In talking to the folks at Baystone, I think they acknowledge that this is a little bit further outside. I think it's about a mile and a half, something in that range. So it's accessible. It's easy enough to get from there and just walk down to the train station or ride your bike, but a little bit more removed.
Well, on another story, one of the things that came up during the campaign last summer and into the fall was the, you know, whether or not there should be parades and a return to like block parties and other things like that. And this weekend, there was a Flag Day parade for the first time in many years.
Yeah, it was the triumphant return of the Flag Day parade in Framingham. So people who have been around Framingham for a long time have very fond memories of this Flag Day parade that the community used to hold each year. It was a volunteer effort to plan this thing each year and get together floats and activities, and kind of expanded to be a whole multi-day event. There was a ball that was held at the Memorial Building and you know, different types of fundraising. So it's something that people have a lot of positive associations with. And so after winning election, Mayor Yvonne Spicer took the initiative to relaunch this parade. I understand this is something that veterans had come to her about and asked her to think about, and so she went for it. So a group planned this kind of first relaunch this year. They didn't have a lot of time to work on the initiative, so I think they're hoping this is going to be kind of a starting point and to build it back up into what it was in the past. But they were back there on Sunday celebrating the flag and the city.
Well, pictures of the parade that were on our website got a lot of traffic, so there's high interest in this. Jim, yeah, thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Happy to do it.
Over the weekend, hundreds of people gathered in Framingham to honor the memory of the late state representative Chris Walsh. Henry Schwann was there and joins us now to talk about that, what happened.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Henry.
No problem. I'm glad to be here. And yes, it was held at Nevins Hall on Saturday. In the afternoon, big crowd, lots of family, lots of friends, lots of people there. And all of them, I think, of the hundreds that were there, all of them had a story to tell about their interactions with the late representative.
What was the one that you took away from? What story was resonated
with me? Yeah, actually, there were three people sitting behind me, and I turned around and I asked them, would anyone like to share with me a story about the late representative? And one of them was, I don't recall her name at the moment, but it's in the story, and she was a town meeting member before Framingham became a city. And she looked out at the sea of people in Nevins Hall who were seated there, and looked over to one area and said, you know, I can still picture the late representative, who was also a town meeting member, sitting there in his customary town meeting seat. And he always, and she said he always wore a scarf because he was a very dapper dresser. So, and that scarf made him more dapper. So that was the story. There were a lot of stories, but that one just sticks in my mind. I don't know why, but it does.
Well, the thing about Chris Walsh is that he was unusual in the sense that he was an architect before he became a politician. And a lot of people say that that brought a different perspective to, or he brought a different perspective to solutions to problems and whatever it was that they were trying to work out in terms of a law or fix a problem. Did they talk about that? Were people who spoke?
Yeah. Yeah, they all did. Yvonne Spicer spoke of that. State Senator Karen Spilka spoke of that. Others spoke of his background. And his daughter, Kate Walsh, also discussed that. They touched on his love of architecture. He was a registered architect. I believe he received his degree from the Rhode Island School of Design. A creative person, a thinker outside of the box. I know that's cliche, but that was presented and discussed by the speakers. And he brought his unique creativity to not only his love of architecture, especially downtown Framingham, Mayor Spicer alluded to that, but also the way he approached his work at the State House. And that creativity, I recall some of the speakers discussing how he would... He was a very good listener, and he also was always willing to sit down with his political opponents and use his creativity and his listening skills and his love of his work to try to reach a common ground. So, yeah, that his architectural background, his love of architecture, his love of his work both architecturally and also as a lawmaker, his love of family, his love of Framingham, all of that was melded into who Chris Walsh was. At least that's what the speaker said.
And before the service started, there was a lot of kind of, there were horses and other things outside Nevins Hall.
Right. Yeah, there were. It was quite a scene. The National Lancers, which are based out of South Framingham, a cavalry, and they went through on horseback I'm not familiar with the actual procession that they displayed, but it was a circular procession in front of Nevins Hall, and then they one by one they stopped in front. They formed a line in front of Nevins Hall and had a moment of silence for the late representative, and it was very moving. A lot of people are out there and captured it on their smartphones and. But it was a very moving part of the ceremony, and then everyone filed into the hall to listen to the various speakers.
We do have photos of the memorial service, and especially what was the pageantry outside on our website, and the link will be with the show notes of this episode. Another story you've been working on for a couple weeks now, Henry, is the Natick School Committee's public speak time during their meetings. There's been some controversy around that, and I understand there's a new twist that occurred just last night.
There is a new twist. Yeah, it occurred last night, and the Natick School Committee...
Why don't you give us some background really quick?
Yeah, so the background here is that public speak is a fancy term for the public comment portion of the school committee meeting in Natick. And public speak is an opportunity for anyone to address the school committee on items that are not on the agenda. And there is a lawsuit that's pending in Middlesex Superior Court. Two former Natick parents are suing the school committee and interim superintendent Anna Nolan, claiming that the policy infringes on free speech. And last week, a Middlesex Superior Court judge issued a preliminary injunction telling the school committee essentially that they can't enforce the policy temporarily because there are questions, concerns about infringement on free speech. So what happened was, hours after last week's decision by that judge, the Natick Public Schools issued a press release saying that we have temporarily decided to postpone the public speak portion of the school committee meetings. So last night...
And so that meant they were not going to have it at all.
They weren't going to have it at all. So last night, they had a meeting at the Morse Institute Library. And the point of it was, at least expressed by the school committee was, we want input from the community before we make a final decision. And several school committee members said that this is a very complicated matter, and it's going to take some time for us, taking in legal advice from the school committee council, to ultimately make a decision.
And the decision would be whether to permanently end the public speaking.
I don't know about permanently, but at least temporarily. At least temporarily.
And the temporarily would give them time to reassess, or?
It struck me as they are there. Again, they stress that it's a complicated issue. We need to balance the input from community members with our advice from legal counsel. The input from community members, Anne, last night was mixed. Some said, go ahead and postpone it, because there are people from outside of Natick who are coming to school committee meetings and disrupting the meeting. Those comments focusing on the policy, and they're very disruptive. And the school committee over the last few months, very disruptive, according to the school committee.
Right.
And the school committee over the last few months has had to postpone several meetings because some public members show up at the meeting and challenge the committee. And the school committee postponed those meetings because they said comments made at those meetings violated their public speak policy, which essentially says, in a nutshell, you cannot defame the school department, school committee members, students, teachers, and you cannot name them. You cannot name them in your address. So that is the point of the lawsuit. The lawsuit says this policy infringes on free speech, and it prevents the public from expressing what it wants to express.
Right. And the two women that
Corey Spalding and Karen Sutter.
They had talked about their kids are no longer in the school district, but had been, and they were talking about problems that they had when their kids were in this school district.
They were there last night, but they did not speak to in the portion of the meeting when the committee asked for public comments. They did not speak. They sat there and they were silent. I just wanted to add that the comments last night by the public were mixed. Some said you need to suspend this policy because these public comments are very disruptive. Others said, no, you can't do this because Natick has a tradition of engaging the public and welcoming the public in any comments that it wants to present in open meetings. And also, the town moderator told the committee last night that the town charter requires you to have public comment. And if you do not have public comment, you are breaking the town charter. You are breaking the law. So the long and short of it is, last night, the school committee indicated that this will be on the agenda this coming Monday night at their meeting. And there's a potential that a school committee member could deliver a motion for a vote. Will that happen? Who knows? I would think that's likely not going to be the case, because members of the school committee repeated last night several times that they need time to get this right.
Well, Henry, thanks for catching us up on this, and
sure
it'll
am.
Be interesting to see what happens going forward.
It will be. Thanks.
Thank you. Former Milford resident Dominic Cristino is expressing his First Amendment rights in a unique way once again. Cristino, who now lives in Upton, has a painted sign out front of his house decrying what he calls corruption, similar to what he did in Milford. Following this story is Scott Causaleo from our Milford Daily News office. He joins us now to tell us more about this story. Hello, Scott.
Hi.
So what's going on with Mr. Cristino?
So, like you mentioned, he had an issue in Milford. He wrote on the back of his truck at one point, Milford Police Chiefs, Kings of Budweiser, no good corrupted, and was later convicted for stalking the chief of police. That charge was later vacated after he spent over a year and a half in prison.
And that was vacated by the appeals court.
By three separate judges, actually. The case was vacated because it was a violation of his First Amendment rights.
He also, I understand, had some Facebook postings as well that were part of this that they felt, the police chief felt was threatening him. And that was the basis, part of the basis for that conviction.
Exactly. And from what I understand, he was seen around town a lot, kind of closely behind the chief, but I'm not sure.
So now he moved to Upton?
Yes, now he lives in Upton, and he's upset about the piece of property that he purchased. The property was owned by the sister or the family of a current selectman, and there are multiple violations which he was supposed to get fixed in a certain amount of time, the town mandated, and he's upset that the family didn't fix it before he purchased the property.
Right. So it was Christina who has to get these, I think it's the septic system needed to be certified. And,
exactly.
Some other issues with the property that Christina was the person who had a certain number of days to get those finished. And Christina saying that these things should have been repaired prior to him purchasing the property.
Exactly. Even though no law really stipulates that you need to have these things fixed before you send, before you sell the property, rather, it's just that he was upset that it hadn't been fixed. And after you purchase the property, they're required to be fixed.
So his sign is he painted the sign to bring attention to this.
So what he did, he put a sign out in front of his yard that says, quote, $158,000 and $30,000 in cash weren't enough. Steve, you slumlord. And he's referring to Upton selectman Stephen Matillion, but the deed wasn't actually under his name. It was under his sister's name.
So there's a feeling that he's aiming this at the wrong person. But in the meantime, Christino and his wife, Erin, were called into court because of these violations. Is that correct?
Yeah, they were in court on, I want to say, June 9th, and they were, the biggest charge was the septic. They needed to get their Title V confirmation, and then there was a couple other additional charges. There's a very large fence being built around the property, and the state wants to make sure that it's within the proper height limits, which is 7 feet. If it's anything above that, it needs to be cut down or they need an engineer. And then there was also the improper signage that was put in front of the house, some of which had profanity on them. And that was a big concern for a lot of town officials.
And so Christino now is and his wife have 30 days or something to comply with these, what the town wants to be in compliance with. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. They have a certain amount of time. I believe it's a month, 30 days, that they have to fix the issues. But Christino seems to think that he can fix these issues himself without hiring outside help. So he's working on it. It's just taking him a lot longer than he anticipated.
So the next step is figuring out, whether they meet that deadline. But also, has this put Christino in any, I guess, some people worry that maybe this will get him in trouble again. The signs will get him in trouble again.
When I spoke to him, he told me that they're just trying to settle down at this point. They don't want to get in any more trouble anymore. But it seems this incident is clearly bringing a lot of attention.
Scott, thank you for taking the time to join us and explain this very complicated story. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
There's a move in Milford to spruce up the downtown area, and more recently, town officials got money to help move that effort along. Joining us now is Christopher Gavin from our Milford Daily News office. He joins us by phone. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Ann.
So what can you tell us about the money that's been made available to the town?
Well, it's right now it's kind of earmarked in the state budget as the State House representatives and the State Senate kind of hammer out the differences, but It's $150,000 that's been set aside in the state Senate budget by Senator Ryan Fatman. And he seems pretty confident that it will go through to the final bill on Governor Baker's desk. But essentially what the Downtown Revitalization Committee plans to do with this money is to put it towards relaunching a facade program to help property owners in the downtown area kind of spruce up their awnings, their painting, what have you.
And this was something that they did about two decades ago under the Main Streets program.
Yeah, it's kind of returned to something that they had done, like you said, about two decades ago, where they received grant money to do something similar, where the grant covered a majority of the costs and the property owner puts forth about 25%, I believe. So what they hope to do, according to the chairman, committee chairman Ron Pagnini, they are looking to use this money from the state to cover 75% of the cost for a business and have the landlord or the owner put forth the 25% of the cost.
And part of the reason that once these places were spruced up, as we keep saying, or made more nice, the outside more attractive and updated, is because the commercial tax rate is so high that sometimes it's hard for these business owners to do this kind of maintenance?
Yeah, that's what Mr. Pagnini had told me, that there's a high commercial property tax rate in Milford. So it's $31.06 per every $1,000 of the assessed value. So whatever the town claims something is worth, is they have to pay $31 per every $1,000. And then that combined with other, expenses that come up for small property owners makes it kind of difficult for them to cover the cost of just simply cosmetic renovations to their properties. He did say that new owners might be able to make changes, so if you have turnover on a property, you can see changes like that if someone wants to do something new with the building. But obviously that can take much longer than making this money available and trying to start the program. To put this in some larger context, the Revitalization Committee is looking at sprucing up downtown and more than just this. They see this program as the first way to kind of make things look a little nicer downtown. From there, they're also hoping to get more people living downtown, changing some bylaws, and this is way off in the future, but trying to get more residences downtown, apartment buildings that can serve like young professionals, et cetera, just to kind of get new and different kind of businesses coming into the area.
Yeah, downtown revitalization seems to be a big move, and it was two decades ago, but now it seems to be taking more hold that people use, and you mentioned in your article, Hudson as and Moody Street and Waltham as two pretty successful downtown revitalization efforts.
Yeah, Ron had made a good point of saying that in my interview with him, that this seems to be something that's not just taking hold in other towns like Hudson, but just really across the country. You have a lot of smaller towns, suburban communities that are looking more towards their main streets, their downtown areas. Like Milford, you got a lot of commercial development on the other side of town, big box stores, et cetera, et cetera. But there does seem to be an atmosphere for an interest in redoing these areas and shifting focus back to Main Street.
Well, you had another story this week, Philomena Pagnini. I don't know if she's related to Ron, of Milford.
It's actually his mother.
Oh, okay.
Coincidentally.
It's a coincidence, right? Well, yeah. Philomena Pagnini of Milford makes sure that her brother Danny is not forgotten every year. And you spoke with her. What was this? What's this about?
Yeah, it was really kind of a touching story, and there's a little story behind just the report, so I'll start there. Philomena came in, her nickname, I'm told, everyone knows her as Ma Philly. So she came in to our office on Main Street last week and wanted to put a memoriam in the paper for her brother, as she has done every year since he passed in 1941 when he was 11 years old. So our family has been doing this for nearly 80 years, coming in, putting in something in the paper every June 11th, And it just, she walked out the door, and it wasn't until afterwards where we got to talking in the office that we thought it would make a great story for our readers. Basically, she puts an in memoriam in the paper every year of a poem written by herself in memory of her brother, Danny Cardone, who had some intestinal complications that he had passed away from very suddenly. But I got to sit down with her and share some of the memories of her brother and what it's meant to try to keep his memory alive.
So is it a poem that she writes herself? Is it a different poem every year?
No, it's the same one every year, but it touches on a few memories that she had. So her brother was known as a very well-established and, I guess, rather convincing businessman as a paperboy back in the day. He'd gone to Sacred Heart School, and he was her older brother by 4 years. So when he passed, it obviously had a big impact on their tight-knit family, and her mother had carried on putting them in memoriam in the paper every year that, you know, if you talk to old-school Milfordians, a lot of them do look for it every year. And she had been putting, the mother had been putting in the paper up until she passed away 20 years ago, and basically when she was on her deathbed, told Philomena to continue on and to make sure that her brother's name did not die with him.
And back to the paper boy angle, didn't he win some type of award just before his death, like days before his death?
Yeah, he was. I think they had announced it. He was set to receive some sort of honor for selling the Saturday Evening Post and being one of the top sellers in Worcester County. One friend had told Philomena years later that, maybe someday he would have been Milford's first millionaire, given his, how charismatic and he seemed to have a real character and a knack for this thing.
Well, Chris, it was a nice story, and it was very popular online. So thank you for joining us to talk about this.
My pleasure.
Last night, Marion High School teachers and former students spanning decades were at the Framingham School for one final time before it closes for good. Zane Rizak was there, and she joins us to tell us about what was going on there last night.
Yeah, it was really cool. They had all like old photos from over the years on the walls, and they had yearbooks from every year in the cafeteria, and we're selling old T-shirts, and you could find your old yearbook in kind of the hallway. So people were kind of wandering around and looking for things to save from the school. So they had a room full of trophies, too.
So were they selling this stuff, or people were basically just coming in and taking things that they wanted to take with them?
Some things were for sale, like T-shirts and the yearbooks. The trophies were kind of just up for grabs, so.
So it was probably a bittersweet moment for many of the people there, especially the teachers, I would assume.
Yeah, one of the teachers I spoke with, Bob Anspach, he was kind of tearing up just talking about, the time he spent there. He taught there for 33 years and had a lot of really great memories. He was, I found him looking through the old trophies because for a few years he served as the athletic director, so he had a lot of good memories and was looking for trophies that had old students' names or even his own kids, because his children also went to Marion.
I was curious, some of the money did go to the Marion High Fund of 2018. Is that money that they're trying to collect to maybe save the school?
That's money to help former students transitioning to other schools.
Oh, okay.
Now that the school is closed and, students are looking for other places to graduate.
Okay. Well, another story that you wrote this week actually surprised me. There's a company in Sudbury, I guess it's near the town hall, that is the country's largest, or the industry leader in the country for machined manufacturing of machine tools. How'd you find this story?
Yeah, so they have their 60th anniversary this year, so they sent us a press release about the anniversary. And yeah, I really like checking out random companies and towns. So I wanted to work on a feature for that company. So what they do is they take...
And the name of the company is?
Oh, Methods Machine Tools. Okay. In Sudbury. It's on Union Ave. So they take generic machines from companies in Asia and modify them to fit specific needs in the U.S. So if a manufacturer comes to them and says, you know, we want a robot that can make fracking guns, that was the example I saw, they can take these generic machines and modify them so it would do that specific thing. So that's what they do, and they have a huge showroom of all these robots doing all these different things, so customers can come in and see, you know, the equipment firsthand.
And you said it was a few blocks from City Hall or Town Hall. Is it in? Is the building kind of generic looking, or would people know that was what's going on in there?
Yeah, there's I guess driving by it, it's kind of striking because it says Method Machines in huge red letters. So a lot of the people I spoke with after the article came out mentioned that they've driven by it a bunch of times and always wondered what was going on. But they have multiple buildings, and some of them are kind of hidden by like shrubs, so it's very mm-hmm. mysterious driving by.
Well, Zane, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Great, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Weekly News Roundup. You can find links to the stories, photos, and videos we spoke about with this episode's show notes. Thank you, as always, to Caitlin Kelleher for producing and editing this episode. You can find the podcast in the Apple Store, Google Play, and on our website, MetroWestDailyNews.com and MilfordDailyNews.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next week.